The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning. So, I've been thinking or studying some lately about the Buddha's ideas of the path, and so I want to share some of these ideas. And I want to do it through telling the story of one of the ancient discourses, one of the ancient occasions where the Buddha gave some teachings. And first I'd like to say that the Pali word, the Buddhist word for path, is magga, or in Sanskrit, marga. And sometimes Buddhism has been referred to as a path more than a religion. There's a... The word religion is a particular coined in the West, and it's not obvious that the word should be applied to the religions of the rest of the world. But we do, because you know, this dominance of Western kind of concepts and ideas. And some Asian cultures had to kind of invent a word to translate the Western word religion into their language. And in Indian religions, one of the words that's sometimes chosen is magga or marga, or at least or it's closely associated. And so Buddhism is a path, meaning a path that we follow, that we walk. And the idea of how we walk, that something we walk, has a very strong connotations of something you put your whole self into. It's not something that you kind of do, you know, just once in a while or... there's what's called the book stand Buddhists, who, you know, just they read books, you know, for going to bed in Buddhism. And the idea is something we put our whole life into, which is kind of also the meaning of being involved in a religion. It has ultimate values that we feel are relevant for the full scope of our lives. And so there was a occasion where the Buddha laid out one version of his path of practice when he came to when he was visited by a king, and it was one of the most powerful kings of his time, Ajatasatru. And the story is a very touching story because it begins with a king at his palace, the terrace on top of his palace, with a bunch of his ministers all around. And it's a full moon night, and apparently it's clear night, very quite beautiful, maybe very still and everything. And they're all sitting there on the terrace enjoying this full moon night. And the king is troubled. And he says, here we are, this beautiful, calm night. Who is it? Who can I go talk to? What religious leaders can I go talk to who might settle my heart? My troubled heart. And at the end of this whole discourse, we find out that this king had killed his father, and that's how he became king. So chances are he was troubled by this, you know, what he had done. And so his ministers start listing the people he should go see, different spiritual teachers of that time. And he says, well, actually, I've already talked to them, and they don't really do it for me. And one of the ministers is silent. So then he turns to the silent one and says, why are you silent? Who do you think I should go see? And he says, well, there's this fellow, the Buddha, nearby, and he's supposed to be quite wise and useful to go see. And so I guess the king had not seen the Buddha, so he ordered that 500 royal elephants be prepared for an entourage to take him to the Buddha. And it's quite a contrast between a Buddha who's sitting under a tree as an ascetic with no possessions and 500 elephants. But in ancient India, elephants were war animals. It's kind of like saying that, you know, get my 500 Bradleys, you know, Bradley tanks ready. You know, we'll go see the Buddha. You know, so here they all these, you know, the full armory goes. You know, he probably has all his guard and soldiers and going along, and they go and they head out, to this woods where it's reported the Buddha is sitting with 1,250 monastics. So it's a big group, right? Remember, it's the middle of the night, full moon night, and the king is, you know, going off and with all his bodyguards with him. And as he gets close to the woods, his hair stands up on end. And he gets scared because there's not a single sound coming out of the woods. And he says, you can't have 1,250 people silent like this. He turned to the minister and says, is this a trap? Are you setting me up for an ambush? And he says, no. In fact, the Buddha is there and his disciples are very well disciplined. And says, okay. So he goes as far as he can with his elephants. Then he gets off the elephants and he walks into the woods and he says, you know, where's the Buddha? Because he sees in this opening 1,250 monastics sitting, quiet, peaceful, not a single cough. And he doesn't recognize the Buddha, and the minister, so he's over there facing, I forget, east, with his back against a pillar. And so he goes up to the Buddha. And they exchange some exchanges, the king said, the Buddha says, what are you thinking about these days? And the king says, well, people are so calm here, so peaceful. This is quite inspiring. I wish that my son could be that calm. the Buddha says, oh, so your thoughts are with the people you love. So it's kind of touching a little bit. So what probably most of you don't know, and which the audience for this text in ancient India would have known, is that his son, who maybe then is just a typical kid, in turn killed his father to become king. So it kind of goes down, family systems therapy. it goes down through the families. So they evoke his son that he loves, but he's not calm. And then he goes to the king asks the Buddha, I've gone around and talked to all these different teachers and asked them this question. What is the fruit of the spiritual life? And particularly said, what's the fruit of those who have engaged in the spiritual life full time? Those who have become home leavers, those who have become ascetics, those who have kind of left the ordinary life in order to devote themselves to a spiritual life. What's the fruit of that? And the Buddha says, well, have you asked other people that? Oh, yes, I asked all these other teachers. And what did they say? Well, so-and-so said that whatever you do has no karmic consequences. You can kill and steal and lie and do all these wonderful things. It doesn't matter one bit. Karma is not going to come back to you. There's no consequence for you. And the king said, well, this was very unsatisfying for me, especially since he's the king. So because if someone is criminal, he just chops their head off. He knows there's consequence. So then I went to talk to someone else, and that person said that there's nothing you can do. You have no power over your life, no power over what happens to you, and you just have to kind of merrily go along with whatever your fate is. And that was very unsatisfying. And I went and talked to someone else, and they said that there are seven parts of the human being which are untouched by good and bad, that doesn't change. And there's no fruit, no results of it, because they're essential essence of who we are. There's the earth element, the fire element, the air element, and the water element. There's something called happiness and unhappiness, and there is the soul. And then the king tells him, well, I asked him about the fruits of the spiritual life, and he answered a different question. He just said that there were these essential parts of us that are, unchanging, and that wasn't the question. So that was unsatisfying. So he goes around, continues to enumerate these different teachings that he heard and why he was dissatisfied with them. And then he goes to the Buddha and says, well, for you, in the homeless life that you teach, in the spiritual life that you teach, are there any fruits? And you have to remember, he's talking about a full-time spiritual life, people who left the life world behind, the ordinary life behind. So the Buddha says to him, Well, King, if you have a slave or a servant who takes care of all your needs, gets up before you, goes to sleep after you, and you know follows your every command, and then that slave or servant decides to go off and become a monastic and leave the homeless life and lives a good life, lives ethically, devotes themselves to a life of integrity, has no possessions except for their robes and their bowl, eats what people offer, kind of lives kind of a very simple, spiritual life of the times, what would you do? And he said, oh, in that case, I would leave them alone and I would bow to that person, appreciating the goodness and what they're trying to do with their lives. And the Buddha said, well, that's one of the fruits of the homeless life. You don't have to be a slave anymore. You know, and the king will bow to you. And then he said, well, are there more fruits to the homeless life? Yes. If there is one of your subjects who's a farmer or a merchant who's providing you with lots of taxes so you can live your life, a wealthy life, and that person decides to leave it all behind and go off and become, a renunciant, what would you do then? Oh, same thing. I would bow to that person, appreciate what they've done, and make offerings to them. The Buddha said, well, that's another benefit, fruit of the homeless life. Yes, but are there even more? The king says. And then the Buddha starts saying, yes, if someone then decides to follow the monastic life, and then he begins to describe the stages of the path that he has. And here we start getting a description, one description of the Buddha's idea of the path to follow. Whether it's supposed to be a linear path, it's presented linearly, if that's really the case, or whether it's kind of all at one or all mixed together, you can decide, find your own way with it. But still, it's offering a path of practice. And now what's remarkable about this path of practice is that there's a distinction made between the things that the person does and the results that happen from them. And there's the actions a person does, the practices a person does, and then there's the states of mind that arise because of doing those practices. The practices are presented like the conditions. You have to put the conditions in place. Without the conditions being there, nothing can happen. But you create certain conditions, then there's a natural arising of states of mind. It's presented in such a way that you're not responsible for making those states of mind arise, but they're more presented as a natural outcome of what you do. So it begins by practicing ethics, living a moral life. And so, and Buddha actually enumerates a whole bunch of ways in which a person in the ancient world would live ethically. For the lay person, often the Buddha talks about the five lay precepts. So no lying, no killing, no stealing, no sexual misconduct, no lying, and no intoxication. And the Buddha says, if a person, and these are all practices of restraint, one doesn't do these things, killing, stealing, these things. Then the Buddha says, if a person does live this way, then they can have the happiness of being blameless. So what arises if you live an ethical life is a sense of well-being that comes from being blameless. No one can blame you. You don't feel like you have a clean conscience. And for the Buddha, that's a source of happiness. Certainly people can recognize it can be a source of unhappiness if your conscience troubles you. And he's talking to the king, after all, who had killed his father. So he knew about what it's like to be troubled. But what many people don't appreciate or don't take the time to avail themselves of is a sense of happiness and well-being that can come from just living an ethical life. Some people live an ethical life, but they don't give themselves enough credit that that's a valuable thing to do. And it can, but it's a valuable and can be a source of happiness. And then the Buddha said, then the person practices guarding the sense doors. And guarding the sense doors, the way it's described, is if you see something, it's fine to see something, be careful that you don't get attached to it. If you hear something, hear it, but don't get attached. Protect yourself. Watch what's going on so you don't get attached to what you hear, see, touch, smell, taste, and also what goes on in the mind. So this is called guarding yourself. And this is a description of what you don't do. You're careful, you pay attention, careful, so you don't get attached to what you see and hear and so forth. The first one of precepts is also what you don't do. The second one is what you don't do more subtly, more deeply in the mind. You don't get attached. This, the Buddha said, gives birth to it's a little hard to know what the original word means, but a non-diffuse happiness. A happiness that doesn't get scattered or kind of gets lost or something. It gets kind of, they are being suffused happiness, maybe. And many people hear the idea of guarding the sense doors and feels like it's a drag. You know, these Buddhists. You know, it's like taking all the fun out of life. But it's not saying don't hear, taste, touch, and all these things, and see things. What it's saying, don't get attached. And in fact, getting attached is one of the primary ways to ruin your happiness. So the Buddha said, don't get attached, and then you can live the joy of restraint, the joy of guarding yourself, the happiness of it. So that's another fruit of the spiritual life, a certain kind of happiness that can come. And the presentation is that Buddha treats it as if a natural thing. Naturally, you would have this kind of happiness. And then he says that a person who, we next practice contentment. And contentment means you don't have discontent with what you have or don't have, that you're happy with what you have. And very important practice for renunciants because they don't have much. In the case of the Buddhist monastic life, it's hard for us to believe because how little they possess, but it was designed in the ancient Indian context to provide people with all the essentials they needed to be healthy and well, but nothing more. It's an interesting exercise to do. What do you really need to be healthy and well? How much could you cut out of your life and do away with and still be healthy and well? And so that's kind of the original idea. It wasn't supposed to be ascetic. So contentment. And I would argue that contentment is also has kind of two things. It's kind of like what you don't do. You don't get discontented. You don't get... And also it's a kind of well-being that wells up. Contentment is kind of a good feeling. To really be content is a nice, comfortable feeling. So here in the first three steps of the path, there's a sense of well-being that comes from taking those steps. There's fruit and benefits right there, each step along the way. It isn't like you have to wait into the far future that, you know, when you get enlightened, that finally you'll be happy. In this path, the idea is to do those kinds of things that can bring you well-being here and now, and things that are available to people to do, be ethically and be careful with how your attachment and try to be content. Then the Buddha said the person practices mindfulness and clear comprehension. As they go about their life, they know when they're walking, they know they're walking. When they're sitting, they know they're sitting. When they're standing, they know they're standing. When they're laying down, they know they're laying down. When they're eating, they know they're eating. When they're putting on clothes, they know they're putting on clothes. As we go about our ordinary life, one really is mindful and clearly present for those experiences. One knows what's there. So cultivating awareness. The next step is to go and meditate. So all this leads up to meditation. And when one sits down to meditate, the instructions are the first thing you do is abandon the hindrances. So this is also a description of what you don't do. You don't allow the hindrances to be there. So by now, I hope you've seen that a lot of what the Buddha is teaching about the path of practice is described by what you don't do. You don't do unethical things. You don't get attached to what you see, hear, and touch. You don't be discontented. And you don't get involved in the hindrances. This is very interesting. Talk about what you don't do. It's not easy not to do some of these things. And that's where it takes a lot of effort and work on this path. And some people, maybe some of you are those kinds of people, in order to avoid doing some of these things, it takes breaking out into a sweat. It's a lot of effort sometimes to avoid some of the tremendous drives and impulses we have for doing things that later we regret. People who have addictions, for example, or people who have a challenge around anger, and they kind of lash out quickly, and it can be very, very powerful, or desire. So abandoning the hindrances. And so the hindrances are sensual desire, which means desire for things in the sense world, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. So you have to abandon those. But then the Buddha says, if you abandon those, then there's a gladness that will arise. The Buddha assumes that if you cannot be caught in the grip of these hindrances, grip of desire or aversion or doubt, that happiness will arise. Actually, the word he uses is gladness or delight. So here again, we have the expectation that as we go along on this path, a certain kind of well-being will well up. So there are, these are the five primary practice. These are the set, as I did go through these different stages of practice, the categories of practice, the practice fall into two categories. What you don't do, and paying attention. That's not too complicated. What you don't do and paying attention. In fact, other places where the Buddha lays out the path of practice, these two categories are the hallmark of what he's teaching. You avoid doing certain things and you start paying attention. And then something begins to flow. Something begins to move through you and it allows space. And what seems to move through us in the beginning is happiness and delight and contentment. Isn't that great? Seems like hard to believe. But this is kind of the expectation of what will arise through doing the practice. And I like to think of it that, I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, the Buddha talked about the states of mind that arise as we practice using the simile of water flowing down a mountainside, rainwater. And as it flows down, it'll flow downhill because of gravity. And as the drops join together into little streamlets, to streams, to creeks, to rivers, and get bigger and bigger down to the ocean. In the same way, these states of mind that come from practice just flow downhill. It's a natural process, unless there's an obstacle. If you put a big boulder in the little stream, it'll block it up and it won't flow. But if you remove the obstacle, the water will flow again. The practices of not doing is removing the obstacles. Being unethical is an obstacle to happiness. Being attached is an obstacle to happiness. Being caught up in the hindrances is an obstacle to happiness. Or obstacle, something nice to flow and move within us. It's a very positive view of human nature. That is, if there's something waiting for us inside, a capacity to be happy, that you don't have to do a lot to be happy, you mostly have to not do. Isn't that nice? I think it's kind of very nice, very positive. It's waiting for you there, a certain kind of well-being. The other practice of attention, awareness, I think of it as making the channels for the water to flow, or making more space for things to flow into. So either you move the obstacles, or we create space, room, which things can flow. There's a flowing story that I told yesterday. and many of you know it, of the philosophy professor who came to the Zen master to ask about Buddhist philosophy. And so the Zen master offered tea. And so the professor held the cup of the teacup, and the Zen master, who's supposed to be a very mindful person, started pouring the tea, and when it got full, he kept pouring. And so the tea started, overflowing. And the professor said, "Oh, stop, what are you doing? There's no more room in the cup for more tea. Stop." And the Zen master said, "In the same way, you're so full of your ideas, there's no room for you to hear anything I have to say." So the idea of making space in the mind for something to happen. So mindfulness kind of is a practice of making space in the field of awareness. Awareness is kind of like having breathing room for things. And when we abandon the hindrances, there's a kind of delight. It's a relief to get our mind back. When we're under the power of attachments and hindrances, we are we're kind of slave. We're kind of in prison of our own self, our own doing. And it's a relief to have our mind back and feel like we have some control and mastery over it and some, not. Then it gets more interesting, because then, from here on out, the stages of practice, the way it's presented and the grammar by which it's presented, it's all things that flow naturally out of that. So you're sitting in meditation and you've finally succeeded to abandon the hindrances. They're no longer present. And then it says, gladness will arise. When gladness arises, joy will be born. It doesn't say, now, gear up and make yourself joyful. Joy up. it says, joy will be born. It'll kind of arise by itself. For someone who's joyous, the body will become tranquil. An expectation that if there's some kind of joy, you kind of can relax. Your whole body can relax and release tension. For someone who is relaxed, tranquil, happiness will occur. It kind of naturally follows. Happiness, someone who is happy, will become concentrated. So in meditation, there is an unfolding, a movement that goes on, and that movement we're not responsible for in terms of what we do. It's mostly we're responsible for it by what we don't do. We kind of get out of our way. We let it flow. And a big part of the art of meditation is getting out of the way and not interfering, not having hindrances, not having attachments, not having a lot of... The other thing that we get in the way is if we take a lot of responsibility for it ourselves. Like it's me, myself, and mine. I'm the one who's doing this. I'm the one who's going to have an attainment. Am I as good as the person meditating next to me? All this eyeing that goes on. In this description of the unfolding in meditation, there's no pronouns here. It's just kind of this natural unfolding of states of mind. And so the Buddha is presenting this a beautiful path without this, emphasizing that, you should think about it in personal terms. So once one is concentrated, then the Buddha talks about one enters into states of meditative absorption, deeper states of meditation, called jhanas. But the way he talks about entering into those, it's also not something a person does. There are some English translation is not obvious because it says, some translators say, one enters and abides in the first absorption. And the word enter could imply there's something you do. However, in the Pali, in the original language, the grammatical form of the word enter is called the gerund, which means it's already happened. So it's having entered. Wait a minute, how did he get in there? How did one get in there? I followed along, gladness, joy, tranquility, happiness, concentration. That's what's all okay. And then suddenly the person's in the first absorption. There's no discussion that the person makes themselves go into this absorption. The way it's presented, it's a done deal. It's just like the water keeps flowing downhill. And then the Buddha uses the same language for three other levels of absorption. And from there, because he's talking to the king about different fruits, he talks about all kinds of special fruits that people can attain that have nothing to do there, nothing essential with the spiritual path. But he just kind of lays out the catalog of things can happen. But the last one he talks about is liberation. And some texts go directly from these four absorptions into liberation. So I wanted to read what it says. With one's mind concentrated, purified, and cleansed, unblemished, free from impurities, malleable, workable, established and having gained imperturbability, one applies and directs one's mind to the knowledge of the destruction of attachments. So this is very interesting, if you followed that, that it says, at some point, when the mind is concentrated and soft and pure and quite beautiful state of mind, one does something here. One directs oneself to notice something. But what one notices is that one is liberated. One notices that the attachments have been destroyed. Here again, what? How did that happen? What did you do to destroy the attachments? It doesn't say that the person then destroys the attachments. It says the person recognizes they have been destroyed. They've been come to an end. So consistently in this Buddha's discussion of the path, it's this natural unfolding without reference to the self who does the unfolding. What we do as a practitioner is we have to create the conditions for the path to the states of mind to arise. But these practices are not practices that involve a lot of doing. They are mostly what we don't do. And then awareness practice is to make space for it all to occur within. That doesn't mean that it's easy, and it can take a lot of time, a lot of months, sometimes years, to be able to come to this seemingly natural state where that's so beautiful, so nice, where all the obstacles have settled away, have quieted down. But the obstacles are not inherent in who we are. Somewhere else the Buddha talked about the obstacles are visitors that visit us. They're not inherent. So we're not inherently stuck with being stuck. We're not stuck with attachments. We're not stuck with the obstacles. We're not stuck with having to be unethical. We're not stuck with having to be discontented. We can develop, we can learn how to let go of these things, get out of our way. We can develop our capacity for awareness. So there's lots of space, lots of open space in our hearts for the flowing of this good qualities of the heart. And then if we can just stay out of the way and trust and appreciate what's happening, then these good states begin to well up that arise from being more and more settled, more and more at home, more and more connected in here. And these are beautiful states that begin arising. And the Buddha talked about it as a flowing river. In my own practice, I thought of it more as, maybe because I'm Norwegian rather than Indian, I thought of it as a snowball that if you go rolling down the hill, as the practice unfolds and you get out of the way, that the snowball keeps rolling faster and faster and gets bigger and bigger. So I don't know if that's an inspiring image for you. Maybe you want to stick with the river. And But that, anyway, the idea is a natural thing. And so the last thing I'll say is that I think in practice, we can almost sometimes see that that there's two sides to practice, to the stages of practice. There's that side of practice which maybe feels more like going up the mountain, and the other side, which means is the flowing downhill. And it feels, it's quite special to come to the top, to the juncture, where on the other side, it just feels like it just begins to flow by itself. So it takes some work initially to learn how to let go of the things you'd be let go of, to learn not to be driven by attachments and desires and obsessions. It takes a lot of mindfulness to do it. It takes some work to cultivate and develop strong attention and awareness. But the advantage, the fruit, the benefit of that is that then we remove the obstacles for a natural functioning of our heart. That's quite beautiful. That's, you know, there's quite a beauty, quite a capacity for beauty within us if we can get out of the way. And all the way to liberation, the destruction of the taints, the destruction of the attachments. And I would like to read the final analogy. It has to do with water again. Of what it's like to be this, what it's like to be liberated. It's an it's just as if, sire. Remember, he's talking to the king. It's just as if, in the midst of the mountains, there were a pond, clear as a polished mirror, where a person with good eyesight standing on the bank could see oyster shells, gravel banks, and shoals of fish on the move and stationary. And the person might think, in this pond, the pond is clear as a polished mirror, with its oyster shells, its gravel banks, and shoals of fish moving about or standing still. So someone with clear eyes can clear pond, clear water, very still, very peaceful. You look into it, and you see, in that clarity, you see the things inside. Just in the same way, when someone's mind is concentrated, purified, cleansed, malleable, workable, one applies one's knowledge to know the destruction of the attachment, one knows as it really is, this is suffering, this is the arising of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, and this is how to bring about the cessation of suffering. So with the same clarity which we see the fish in the shoals and things, one can really see the nature of suffering, how it arises, how it ceases, and in that seeing, one becomes free. So the path of practice, the magga. So we have a few minutes. Any questions or comments about that you'd like to make? Or anything else? I saw your hand there. If you can maybe...
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. I thought I had three, but anyway, two is a good number. So how do we get out of the natural state to start with? I assume as kids, you know, we just...
It's a good question.
So that's the one?
when the Buddha was asked something similar to that, he said, no beginning could be discerned.
Say what? Say that again? Yeah.
No beginning could be discerned. You know, some of our tendencies towards attachment and clinging and aversional things, we're kind of born with. You know, it's not necessary. So it's also pretty natural to have desire, greed, hate. You know, it's also natural. So, but it depends which part of our natural being we want to give birth to, and what we want to emphasize. And so, a little bit. You know, I don't know if it's fair to them to ourselves to use this analogy, but it's kind of like there are greed, hate, and delusion are more natural functionings of the mind. Happiness, joy, love, compassion are natural functionings of the heart. And it's possible to do something about the mind. The mind is malleable, it's changeable, can be worked with. But we kind of come in wired for those kinds of things, greed, hate, and delusion. And sometimes they can get triggered and accentuated by what happens to us as children. We can learn from, you know, we learn from what's around us. People learn, sometimes learn hate from the environment. Sometimes people have terrible things happen to them growing up, and so a tremendous amount of hate and hostility gets born because of how they're so hurt, and so that also is a cause for it. But from the Buddhist point of view, besides for these kind of childhood traumatic things that can happen, or conditioning that can happen, it seems that he just took it to be, kind of just came along with being born, but we're not necessarily stuck with it.
And, was there an end to the king's story there?
Oh, yes.
Did you want to share that with us?
Oh, the king, yes. So the king says at the end, excellent. and he says, very happy with all this. And then he says, I go for refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. That's nice. And then he says, please accept me from this day onward as a lay follower for the rest of my life. And then he makes his confession. A transgression overcame me. Foolish, erring, and wicked as I was, in that for the sake of the throne I deprived my father, that good man and just king, of his life. May the Buddha accept my confession of my evil deed, that I may restrain myself in the future. So that's nice. Then the Buddha says, indeed, a transgression overcame you. But since you have acknowledged that the transgression and confessed it as is right, we will accept it. For one who acknowledges a transgression as such and confesses it for betterment in the future will grow in the path. At this, the king said, Buddha, permit me to depart now. I am busy and have much to do. Well, what happened to all this good teaching he got? And the Buddha, as the Buddha does, he said, well then, do as you see fit. And the king, rejoicing and delighting at these words, left. As soon as the king had gone, the Buddha said, the king is done for. His fate is sealed. But if the king had not deprived his father, that good man and just king of his life, then as he sat here, the pure and spotless Dhamma eye would have arisen in him. So in these ancient teachings, there's like five really bad things you can do that guarantee you, apparently, rebirth in hell realms. And one of those five is to kill a parent. So it seems like that's, you know, luckily you're not going to be in hell for a long time. I mean, you're not forever. Buddhist hells are temporary. But in this ancient mythology, that it's temporary, but it can feel like eternity when you're there because it's a very, 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 very long time. Millions and millions of years. So eventually you'll come out. And then you get to try again. It's like Groundhog Day.
Which king was that?
Which king? Ajatasattu. Ajatasattu.
Is his father Bimbisar?
Yeah. Yes.
I wonder if there is a benefit to teaching these things that we avoid instead of describing what we should do. You know, when I work with children, we'd never get very far if we just told them what to avoid. because they'd be stymied, and all they'd be focused on is what not to do. I mean, you know, all I have to do is say to people, don't desire ice cream. Right? What's everyone thinking right now? So is there a benefit in the way that it is taught? I really have struggled with this. Every time you say avoid this, I translate in my mind, do this other
thing.
Good.
That's a common thing that many people, especially here in the West, have reworded like the precepts in positive terms. In terms of the precepts, the positive terms tend to be more vague, what they mean. They're inspiring, but they're more vague. The negative statement is pretty clear what killing is. You know, respecting life, well, you know, I respected the cow that I butchered, but so not killing is pretty clear. You know, so the precept has clarity to it. Also, I think there's a lot wonderful things to do that support our heart, that support the practice. In Buddhism, there is emphasis on generosity and many of these things that you do. However, those things are never described in the stages of the path itself. So I think that this description here is not meant to be a full prescription of how a person lives a good life, because other places we're taught to do things like generosity and kindness and loving kindness and compassion, things like that. And those are good things. But these are this description here was for people who have prepared themselves and are inspired and are ready to go plunge in completely into that path. This is not for children. This is for people who are mature and ready and feel like, oh, I'm ready to do this. And supposedly they've, you know, then learning to not do doesn't tie themselves up, or doesn't mean that they don't develop themselves. They're already developed enough to be inspired to do this, feel the value of it. And the last thing I'll say about, as a teacher, I meet plenty of people who are trying sincerely to practice, but because they think of practice as what they have to do, they tie themselves in knots. Some people have so much complications around being the doer, about attainment, expectations, and being successful, that sometimes it takes a lot of work to help support people. Back off. You know, don't. You know, you're tying yourself in knots with all your sense of being the agent and the responsible, and it's up to you. And so, this description here is meant for people who are, well mature, not for kids.
Thank you,
all of you. So, I hope this was nice to hear all this, and I hope that if nothing else, that it was provocative in having you think about what's inside of you, what's in your heart, and might there be something really positive and wonderful in there if you can really relax and give it space to come forward. And the hope is that the Buddhist practice can support that to come forward and let it kind of grow and develop. Thank you.